Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Getting caught in the wrong shoes can interrupt your plans for the day. Like when that 10% chance of rain ends up looking more like 100%. When the transition to fall and winter feels more like experiencing every season on the same day, there's the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Cross off errands with the splash protection on the Wool Runner Mizzle. Dash through cold and wet weather with all-condition traction and reflective details on the Wool Dasher Mizzle. Or upgrade to next-level protection with the Mudguard on the Wool Runner-Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.
Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined by my psychic and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Good evening, Windy.
And our tactics guy and my esports champion, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Hello, mate.
How are you coping, boys? How are you coping with life?
It's been weird. Work has been really busy. I work in internal comms, so it's been really busy for us. But getting by, Windy. A bit nervous about a possible lockdown and what that means about getting outside and running around. And but okay.
How about you, Nathan?
Yeah, so I work from home as it is, and I sort of live in the middle of nowhere. So I'm often sort of trapped indoors for a day or two at a time as it is. So I'm kind of used to things, but then like I'm not getting that break away every few days, you know, in the evening. So it's starting to wear a little bit, but you know, I'm coping. You?
Yeah, I'm doing okay at the moment. First working day that I didn't go to work. Last week I kind of had to go to work, which was really frustrating to me because I felt like I was massively a part of the problem. Whereas today I work from home, I felt more ethically sure of footing, and it was fine. I had like 10 Skype calls today, so I felt like I've not been off Skype all day. So just what I want to do this evening is Skype you two. But it's amazing how quickly you can transition to working remotely. I usually have two screens at work, and I'm having to make do with one at home. But other than that, it's really not that much of an issue in my job, which is quite interesting.
There are thousands of disabled people around the world who are applying for jobs over the last several years and being told that they can't do them because they can't work from home. Yeah. And lo and behold, they could have done all along, and we have those capabilities, don't we?
It is very enlightening in that respect. I think that the genie's out of the bottle now. It can't go back to how it was before. And I think that's a good thing. Bardi, how are you keeping yourself occupied without football?
To be honest with you, I find moments where I miss it, but on the whole, Spurs have been so bad that I'm quite enjoying this. I'm quite enjoying the freedom away from it, thinking about other things. And to be honest with you, I spend most of my day just because my wife is working from home as well, just trying to find a rhythm of working without annoying her. And being able to share the monitor like you as well. I need two monitors. She needs two monitors. So I've had to bite the bullet in the end. I just went out and bought another one. But just trying not to annoy her too much is kind of how I'm passing my day.
And how about you, Nathan? Are you missing football?
So I'm still like working in football, so I'm still watching a fair amount of football, just not live. And pretty much I was getting to the point where the only live football I was watching anyway was Tottenham, who I was watching out of sort of a sense of duty and sort of like a continuation of Twitter, so not particularly for joy anyway. So it's not been a massive... I mean, I will definitely start to miss it down the line. I will miss the sort of the routines. Obviously, I'm playing FIFA instead of watching Spurs instead. So that's interesting.
Yeah. No, I clicked on your link to watch a bit of the game, or what I thought was going to be a bit of the first match you did, thinking this is really frivolous and stupid, what am I doing? And ended up like basically watching the whole thing and hating myself for it.
You are welcome.
I just want to give a little shout out to Joe, who emailed me some feedback for a bonus episode that I did with Chris Thatcher, the Puppeteer. I called the episode The Puppet Master. Joe sent the sweetest feedback and it was really, really appreciated. So I wanted to give him a mention. And I really enjoyed my chat with Chris, as I think came across. I was very enthusiastic because I love the Dark Crystal. Lots of people would have like listened to the first 5 minutes and probably switched off because it wasn't their thing. But if you did that, go back and listen, because it was lovely to talk to Chris about that, but also about his love for Spurs, which I thought really came through. Great bloke, and I thought it was a great chat as well, if I don't say so myself.
He was an interesting chap. Dark Crystal kind of slipped my mind, and then when he started talking about it, I just had in my head, because I was listening to it as I was running, the puppets with the big noses, and I heard him talking about it. Then I went home and checked it, and I realized that was the show that used to scare, that was the film that used to scare the living crap out of me when I was young. And I'm going to give that a watch and go and try the Netflix series as well.
Nice one, do. It's very good. It's even if you don't like the storyline, you just watch it and appreciate the art of the whole thing, because it is incredibly put together. It's really impressive. What we're going to do here, we've put out a call for questions, and Nathan's very kindly sort of put them into some themes. So we'll start off by talking about the potential appointment of a director of football, because lots of different people asked about this. So if I start with Bill Photo 3, who said, not a specific question, but I'd like to hear everyone's thoughts on a director of football coming in and how that makes them feel about Mourinho and the club next season and beyond. So Nathan, let's start with you. How do you feel more generally about the idea or the prospect of a director of football coming in at Spurs once again?
Yeah, I think that it's overdue. I think that it's not a model that we should have abandoned, just perhaps the specifics of what we tried before and who we tried before and the managers and so on. So I was listening to it might have been Camoli on the Athletics podcast special thing with him, where they talked about the fact that the idea of a director of football back when he was at Spurs was sort of like this weird modern continental thing not that long ago, and now it's like it's weird if you don't have a director of football. It's old fashioned if you're still operating with that one, and I think that is true for us. Sort of Daniel Levy has obviously been operating as our director of football, as our chairman, and I think that he is recognizing that for all of the good he has done in that role, and he has done a lot of good and obviously brought us quite some way. He is not a football expert. That's not his strongest skill set. You know, he obviously has generic business negotiating skills, and he will still be able to carry on with those abilities. But he's not a director of football, and we should bring a specialist in who's demonstrated elite level ability in that role.
Indeed. I mean, you know how annoying it is at work when you're boss kind of pokes his nose into stuff that really is well below his pay grade and should be left to the people entrusted to do that job. With that in mind, Bardi, how do you feel about this?
I mean, we've had mixed successes with directors of football. I think it's needed, but if you kind of look back through the history of them at Spurs, from David Pleat, Arneson, Camoli, and I don't actually know if Camoli had that official title, but someone there. And
was he sporting
Baldini,
director?
Perhaps, yeah, but I think he was kind of tasked perhaps with the same responsibilities. We've had mixed successes, but that's kind of the way it is with a lot of transfers. They do work and they don't work. I think Daniel Baldini, he's probably upset us and probably kind of tainted the idea of a director of football for most football fans, especially Spurs fans, with the history of the Magnificent Seven. But yeah, I think it's needed somebody to identify players, do the transfers, remove Levy from it, and then perhaps just report into Levy, speak to the manager, and then just give Mourinho the players he needs, take that responsibility off him. I think there was definitely a drop off in Pochettino once he decided he wanted to be everything, and maybe that had a knock-on impact on his attitude and the way he was unable to see his players and his team anymore. And he seemed a little bit lost towards the end.
Buddy, you just made some great points, but I can't help but focus on the fact that you said Daniel Baldini.
Yeah.
And to me, that sounds like something that people would nickname Daniel Levy because he's bald. And I just can't stop thinking about it. Franco Baldini.
Franco, of course.
Oh, sorry, that really tickled me.
Just pod title.
Daniel Baldini. I fully agree with everything you just said there. So talking about sort of specific directors of football, we had a question from Ross Wagstaff, who said, do we have any insight on Luis Campos or Florian Maurice and any particular players they may recommend to Levy from their current teams or the French league? So I guess that's the first thing to say. They're both in Ligue 1 at the moment. So Campos is at Lille and Maurice is at Lyon. Both have some kind of headline good players. Lille have the Nigerian forward that we've recently been linked with, Victor Osimhen. I think it's Osimhen, is how you pronounce it. And also Boubacary Soumaré, who's the French defensive midfielder. And Lyon have plenty of good players. So Memphis Depay is one we've been linked with many times. They've got Moussa Dembélé up front. They've got, is it Aouar, Nathan?
Yeah, Hossam Aouar.
Who you like very much.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Are there any other... do you think we should be targeting these players? Could we get these players? Or do you think there are any other players that we should be looking at?
Yeah, something I noticed a lot over the summer when I was sort of hyping up Ndombele prior to us signing him is there was a lot of pushback on the idea of signing players from Ligue 1. There seems to be a sort of a negative perception, and I find that like really baffling. I've long thought, and I continue to really think of the French league as a really good place for sourcing Premier League talent. I think like Eden Hazard and N'Golo Kanté, like Ligue 1 is really quite physical and fast paced, and I think that really helps with the crossover between the two leagues. So I it just arrives to me that there's this perception that it's a bad league to sign from, and I couldn't disagree more.
Do you think people are scared because of Clinton and G and, you know, George Kevin and Kudu?
But those were bad signings in their own independent way. I think actually there was some more upside that we could potentially have explored there, at least sort of purely as a footballer. But Nkudu was always a bad signing. Was a bad signing at the time, was obvious to everyone, was completely baffling, and that's that. You know, he didn't perform well in Ligue 1. That doesn't make Ligue 1 a bad league to sign players from. That makes him a bad signing.
Benji Stambouli.
Well, you know, he was all right.
But you know what I mean, though? This scares people, doesn't it? When they've seen the calibre of player we've signed previously, people get put off. And I think that's understandable. But as you say, they're just bad players.
Yeah, yeah. You can find a bad signing from every league that we signed from, for sure. That's the nature of the risk of football and all of that.
How about you, Bardi? Any players in the French league that you you like or think we could get?
No, I didn't realise. I just have to compile a dossier on the French league. But I do think we as Spurs fans, we do get very superstitious. And if a couple of transfers haven't worked from one country, we do get worried. But we do seem to have an issue with Brazilian players. So that's always, as soon as we sign a Brazilian player, everybody gets a bit nervous. But I think you can't say a player from a certain country doesn't work. I just think you've got to look at the scouting and look at the players who were bought. So just because we've bought badly from the French league doesn't mean there's bad players. As Nathan said, Kante, there's been plenty of examples like that who are successful. But then you could always look at Nicolas Pepe, who's awful. He came from the French league. I just had to get that in there because Windy's a huge fan of Pepe.
Oh, Bardi, you're always taking shots, aren't you? So, I mean, my thoughts on the director of football conundrum are that it's an essential part of the puzzle. And I say that with a couple of things in mind. First, I think that the kind of approach we've taken to transfers over the last few years has been pretty bad. I mean, we've signed some good players, sure, but I think it's been... I kind of want to almost say more luck than judgment, which feels harsh, but I think is probably correct. Mm. And it feels like we've kind of forced ourselves into a position where we had to spend a lot of money to get the right players in because we haven't been canny with our searches and trawls of the transfer market. We haven't used data well. We haven't built up connections. We haven't been loaning players successfully. So all these little things add up to me to be an issue with the transfer policy. And if a director of football coming in can help resolve some of those issues, then great. That will be very helpful. So we know that the people who work on transfers have been the head coach. So Pochettino was a big part of the transfer committee. Daniel Levy, Steve Hitchin, who's the chief scout, I believe, and John McDermott, McDermott, who it's been announced is leaving Spurs, who's the head of the academy. So, you know, in theory, you've got all the right components there in the room and it's still not working. So why not try something else is my primary thought on that.
I think we had a question about McDermott that I forgot to include. Can we just get your thoughts on McDermott leaving?
Yeah, sure. So I interviewed McDermott about 10 years ago, and he's a very interesting man. He's a very imposing, slightly terrifying man. typical, like, did you ever have like a really aggressive PE teacher at school?
Yeah, I know who you mean. Yeah.
That's who he reminded me of massively. Gotcha. Like very loud, booming voice, sort of
a threatening aura.
Threatening aura, an aura of toxic masculinity about him.
Yes, yep.
I heard mixed things about McDermott. So like when you meet him and when you hear him speak, he is incredibly impressive, and there's no denying that. Certainly when he came in at Spurs, he added structure to our academy and he brought through some fantastic players, including Harry Kane, probably the best youth player we've ever brought through, arguably.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you kind of applaud him for that. But I think from what I've heard, there have been some issues in the past. And of course, individual players will always say there's been issues when things haven't gone right for them. But, you know, last year he was aligned with Pochettino and stopping players going out on loan, which has ended up with us losing players permanently because they just want to get out of the club. I don't think he found solutions to that problem, and I think that was partly his job to do so. I also think that there's an issue with the sort of type of player we're developing.
Okay.
And by that I mean we bring through lots of sort of functional midfield players and centre-backs. We don't bring through many creative players, and I think that might be something to do with the philosophy that runs throughout the academy. So whilst for nostalgia reasons I'm sorry to see McDermott go, and I obviously wish him all the very best with the FA. I hope he does a fantastic job and has a long and successful career there. I think maybe it was time to freshen things up and get a fresh approach in the academy at Spurs, and I look forward to seeing what we decide to do. The problem is that we've had a drain of all our talent. So we've lost Justin Cochran, Chris Ramsey, Alex Inglethorpe, who else? Gosh, Scott Parker. So, you know, there's been people at the club who have been very, very highly rated for one thing or another and have moved on elsewhere, taken their skill sets elsewhere. So we've been constantly reappointing. So we've got quite a sort of junior academy set up now. We need someone a bit more senior with a bit more experience and a bit more know-how, I think. Interested to see how Spurs replace McDermott and handle that transition with the academy. It'll be fascinating. Nathan, we need to talk about your video. We spoke about it very, very briefly in the last time we were all together. But do you want to just talk us through what you did about Mourinho?
Okay. So I've been operating on this idea that Mourinho's tactical ideas are outdated. So I've sort of laid that sort of idea pretty openly several times. And I wanted to sort of critique my own place. Obviously, I've had pushback on that, which is fair enough. But I wanted to give that pushback the strongest possible argument so I could then analyze that. So, you know, not taking your opposition's strongest possible claim and working backwards from there. And so the strongest possible claim that Mourinho is still an elite, current, brilliant manager is that he won the Premier League not that long ago. So I went through Chelsea's 14-15 season and looked at how they played, looked at how modern it was, how repeatable that would be till now. So how the league has changed in that time and how much it hasn't changed in that time. And then a sort of a little bit of a look at those same patterns with the current Spurs side and how that is and isn't working out for him.
And what were your key findings from all his work?
I guess sort of a compromise, which I guess is to be expected in that there was definitely some modernization, of course, because it had to be to win the league as recently as 2015. But the league has changed a moderate amount, enough that I think. So I put forward the idea, like, how would a 2015 Chelsea perform in the 2020 Premier League? And I don't think that they would win. That's kind of obvious because of the strength of Man City and Liverpool this year. But I think that they would have some tactical difficulties with the technical level of the majority of Premier League's sort of defenders on the ball, and also the growing ability of opposition sides to press. What surprised me was Chelsea's own pressing, not from like a sort of to the medium high block that they use, which is sort of what I'm referring to when I talk about technical defenders on opposition sides. But there, once Chelsea get the ball into the final third and they maintain the pressure, they're good at winning the ball back. With, you know, Fabregas was surprisingly strong in his ability to sort of counter press in the final third, and obviously Matic is very good at sweeping up in that sense. But yeah, the way that they pressed from the front while they were on top was really impressive to me. Mm. And I think that for me was one of the most important facets of Pochettino's Tottenham. So if Mourinho could recreate that ability at Spurs, that would do us a hell of a lot of good.
So you were looking at this from the perspective of Jose Mourinho. Can he evolve? Can he try something new?
Yeah.
Did you, in amongst all this research, did you spot any kind of stylistic similarities with Mourinho's Tottenham and Mourinho's Chelsea?
Definitely. So we're talking again about the high-medium block, and this is... So the opposition have a goal kick, they pass out to the defenders pass between themselves, and they begin to work the ball through midfield, right? How do you set up in that situation? And what we saw from that Chelsea side, and what we are seeing again now from Tottenham, is a 4-4-2 defensive shape where the two forwards push up pretty high and begin to sort of interact with the defenders as they are receiving the ball, or maybe if one of them takes a step forward, that kind of thing. That's something that we're seeing at both clubs. And that worked really well for Chelsea because they had a front line of Costa and Oscar, two really brilliant presses of the ball, absolute workhorses, and they sort of gave centre-backs a scare. Centre-backs would rush into the full-back, and that's where Chelsea could pin their full-back in and win the ball there. And I think if you look at Spurs pressing against Norwich, if you look at our pressing against Aston Villa in recent weeks, you'll see us try to do a similar thing, and the opposition simply, you know, drop in a central midfielder, make a nice little triangle with a centre back, a full back, and a central midfielder, and just work the ball around us, and then suddenly we're open. And I think that it's not like a dramatic change. It's not like teams were never passing out the back in 2015. It's not like all teams are Barcelona in 2020. But there's been enough of a shift that teams that a high medium block is really hard to execute.
I also think the quality of teams in the Premier League is just better now as well, probably due to the financial situation.
There's more of an imbalance between like the current top two and the rest of the league than there was then, I think. But like football as a whole has, or at least the Premier League as a whole, has developed just in a broad technical aspect, I think.
I think definitely the level of ability throughout the league has improved. The quality of managers has improved, and of course the TV money allows teams like Wolves, even like throwing a name out there, Bournemouth, they have more spending power than an equivalent team in the Spanish league or the Italian league. So it just means the pool of players now open to Premier League teams is massive. So I think that's had a massive impact on the level of quality.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, Nathan, because I'm hugely paraphrasing, but one of your findings was that Mourinho's Chelsea really tried very, very, very hard to get the first goal. And I've noticed that Mourinho's Tottenham really tried to get the first goal. The problem is that we often don't. Whereas Mourinho's Chelsea team often did, and then they were able to manage the game from that point. Do you think that's one of the issues?
So that's sort of like a fundamental testament of Mourinho, is that the first goal is huge, and that he doesn't take risks when the game state is neutral. He's always been about manipulating the game state, and he sort of like admitted the negative as much recently when he said once we want a goal down against Chelsea, he said, well, once an opposition team has a goal against us, we're lost because we can't attack and we can't defend. Which is, you know, a huge, huge admittance on his own tactical weaknesses. Obviously there were scenarios where 2015 Chelsea conceded the goal and came back, so it's not like an absolute impossibility. But one of the, and again, you can look at his United side. Certainly the United side that finished second, although I think David De Gea sort of dragged them to second, to be honest. It's all about that first goal, and once you're a goal ahead, you can force the mistakes out of the opposition. So I talk about like proactive and reactive a lot. So the idea of Mourinho as being like a traditionally reactive manager who has had to adapt to proactive ideals, and what what he's done is he's attempted to marry the two. So he is proactive when there is an even game state, but he is true to himself. So as soon as Chelsea or Spurs are a goal or maybe two goals up, that is the point that they say, okay, now we can sit back, now we can counter. And that's really our biggest strength, is once we have a goal up in our advantage, it's our game and we can force lesser teams to play with the ball.
And I think that's potentially the crux of why you have some people who say Mourinho is a defensive manager and some people who say, no, he's not. He's just a normal manager, because for those opening few minutes when there's no goal in the game, he's not especially defensive. He's desperate to get that first goal. He's also desperate not to make any mistakes. But
yeah,
his sides do attack. They certainly do attack. And that Chelsea side, I remember being a really fluent attacking unit, and they played some attractive stuff
at times. I think that certainly Mourinho fans will overplay how attractive it is. There's definitely a lot of fluidity with the attacking midfield three. That was a major feature of the way that they played. But I think also when people talk about is Mourinho attacking or defensive, they say, well, look at the number of goals that his Real Madrid side scored. Look at the number of goals Chelsea scored that season. Look at the number of goals even United scored the season they finished second. It's like, yeah, but most of those goals he's scoring once they're able to play on the counterattack. And you can pick out those counterattacks and say, well, this is a very attractive counterattack. And that's absolutely true. But he's not someone, and Real Madrid players sort of have mentioned this in the past, he's not someone who actively coaches counterattacks. He's someone who allows very good attacking players into counterattack scenarios where they improvise. And that does result in good football to watch and impressive attacks that result in goals. But that's manipulating the game state to score those goals. So he's not going out and forcing those goals against a defensive side, which is the biggest skill in football. He's scoring them on the counter, which is not to say that those are like illegitimate. Those don't count. That's not the point. I'm just saying that like that doesn't that there's a importance in how you underline his skills there.
And if we can sum it up in one final sentence or two, do you feel better about Mourinho having done this research?
A bit better, somewhat better, but not like completely changed my mind sort of thing.
Okay, fair enough. Right, we'll go back to your question. So Lenny P. Cover says, are players peaking earlier than 20 years ago? On paper, our squad should be peaking and not over the hill. The only slight exception being Toby and Jan, but early 30s for a centre-back isn't too bad. Or did Poch knacker them all? Bardi, what do you think? Do you think players are peaking earlier than they were 20 years ago?
I think players are far more, the exposure of players happens to them when they're far younger, because before we would have to wait for a major tournament or a European Cup or something like that to really bring the focus of a young player who wasn't based in England to our attention. So I think now we're finding out about these players earlier. For example, Mbappe has been on the radar for a long time. So that perhaps ends in our thinking that they're kind of declining because they've been around for so long. But if you look at players, Ronaldo, Messi, Neymar, these are guys, well, those two are in their 30s. Neymar's approaching 30. They're still maintaining that level. In Italy, as always do, I like to bring it back to Italy, they think you're a young player until you hit to 25. They reckon before you get that exposure, you've got to, you know, make your bones in the under 21s, do all the tournaments. So they've always been quite to their detriment. They've always held players back a lot longer than they would essentially do here in England. Owen, Rooney are two examples of players who were kind of thrown in to major tournaments at a super young age, where if you think perhaps the last young player to burst onto the scene for Italy is, I don't know, Baggio in 1990 or Balotelli at Euro 2012, but he'd already won the Champions League and won the league at Man City. So I think there's a perception that players are burning out faster just because we're aware of them longer. At Tottenham, I don't know. We don't know unless you go into the future and have a look. I don't think it's down to Pochettino really burning out players. I don't think you can hold our manager responsible for that.
How about you, Nathan? Do you have thoughts on the player peak?
Yeah, I disagree with Bardi. I do think that players are burning out earlier. I think that football is more athletically demanding than it was. I think and they're playing sort of similarly over the top number of minutes. But yeah, I think players are maybe starting earlier, but playing a more physically demanding version of the game and nattering out earlier. And I've mentioned before that Pochettino is sort of one of the managers who is leading the way on that. But I think that that is just just the way that football is going. And like developmentally, like it's always been about the playoff between like so players continue to develop mentally throughout their entire playing career and like even beyond as they become coaches, etc. So they get, you know, you get smarter with age, but you also slow down as you get older. So it's always been about finding where the window between the sort of the athletic peak crossed over with the mental peak, and that used to be later on. And as the game has become more athletic, it has also become more micromanaged. So the decision-making process is decreased on the player's end as they are maybe better coached, but maybe just more strongly coached in the mental aspects. So you need less of the smartness of older players and you need more of the legs of younger players. And so football becomes a younger game.
So you just said something really interesting there, and that was where my research led me as well, which was around it being more important to look at the team age rather than individual players' age. So essentially, you need a combination of older players and younger players in the team, which I think makes sense just from a sort of practical perspective. The research I looked at suggested that in 1992, the average age of players in the Champions League was 24.9. And now it's closer to 27. So actually, Yeah, I know. I was quite surprised that it's the opposite of what you'd imagine. Yeah. So actually, players perhaps aren't peaking earlier. They're peaking a little bit older, closer to 30. But I think it's also, it's positional as well. So the research also said that elite forwards and wingers tended to be a lot younger, and it's likely that that's due to the importance of explosiveness and speed.
Which
again makes total sense. You always assume an exciting winger is going to be like 21, 22, 23. Once they get to Aaron Lennon's age, they have to use different skills. They haven't got that amazing burst of explosive speed anymore, and they have to develop other areas of the game. Goalkeepers obviously tend to play a lot older as well.
Yeah, if you look at the kind of Ballon d'Or list and players that have been involved, they're always players at the later end. I think we as a public just get bored of individuals.
Do you know what? I think that's such a good point. I really do.
We've seen, obviously there are players who do fall off a cliff, but we get so bored of seeing Iniesta, these guys who have been playing for at such a high level that we just take it for granted. Luka Modric, for example, he peaked as he got older. The older he got, the better he got. So I think on the whole, players do peak at the right time. I think there's exceptions, of course, who die. Michael Owen, those kind of guys, they die. They've got nothing left in their legs. Players who essentially are reliant on speed. But I think the very best players are able to sustain it over a longer period of time, because they just have a wider skill set more than just their body.
Indeed, and we can look at the improvements in kind of off-field things, like, for example, sports science, like dietitian, like strength and conditioning coaches being a part of the first team training coaching unit. These things will help. They'll help sustain players' careers a little bit longer. But Nathan also makes a really valid point that we're putting players through so much football, particularly in the case of Spurs, where we've had a very sort of small, tight squad under Pochettino, and we've flogged our players like you wouldn't believe. I mean, the number of games that the likes of Alderweireld and Kane and Dele played over the last few years, it's just too many, frankly. They shouldn't be playing the number of games that they are. And so you'd expect them to perhaps have a slightly shortened career as a result of that. So I do think Pochettino has something to answer for by not kind of having a larger squad and rotating a little bit more. But at the same time, you know, he nearly won us the Champions League. So in one sense, kind of did the best he could with what he had, and who can blame him? He's not thinking of 10 years down the line. Interesting question though, wasn't it?
Shocked. I'm absolutely shocked. I'm looking it up now, and I'm finding the same findings that you are, that players are getting older. I'm so shocked by that.
I think it will change. I think that will change over the next few years, because we're developing such good young players, and we'll find a bit more churn perhaps, because players in elite academies will be brought through once the trust's there in young English players, which will take some time to develop. There'll be a little bit more churn, and we'll see more refreshing of squads more regularly. But yeah, it was quite interesting. I found it quite surprising as well. Next one is from Stu Irving, who says, With them both now in the Premier League, how do you feel about signing Lo Celso instead of Bruno Fernandes? So, Nathan, obviously different players, but are you happy that we got the right person?
I am, yeah. So this is paraphrased. This is born out of a conversation that sort of happened over the course of three or four tweets. Because someone was not the first person to draw a comparison between Bruno Fernandes and Tanguy Ndombele. And I don't think that's how it was. I think that we chose Lo Celso over Fernandes, or we couldn't land Fernandes and settled for Lo Celso. But I'm really happy with Lo Celso. Like, I'm really, really pleased with his performances. How it took a little while to settle in, but he's brilliant. And like, Fernandes is now at United, now in the Premier League, and we can see how well he is performing. And he is also really absolutely brilliant. So like, there wasn't really a wrong answer between these two, I don't think. Like, narrowing it down to these two and having these two as options was like a really strong place to be in. But I think, and this is sort of what I said before, and it's ringing true, is that like, Fernandes is more individualistic, is more sort of looking to score the goals himself, is more of a number 10, whereas Lo Celso is more contributing and build up, making the play, controlling the tempo, carrying from deep, more able to play central midfield, that sort of thing. And I think that both for our needs, as we believed them to be at the time, and also as they have turned out, which is really bad, we more needed Lo Celso to sort of knit things together for our squad of bumbling idiots than we did need Fernandes to just sort of win games for us on his own.
I love that, squad of bumbling idiots. Yeah,
they're not, obviously there's a lot of talent in the squad. We're just like in a messy place with the balance and everything.
Yeah. I feel, for me, Lo Celso could become my favourite player within a year. I absolutely love watching him play. He reminds me, he's sort of like a mixture of Modric and Eriksen.
Yeah.
Sort of somewhere between the two of them. Obviously, he's not got anything like Eriksen's output yet. Hopefully that will come. But he looks such a good player. Bardi, how do you feel on this one?
Yeah, I kind of agree with what Nathan said. At the time, we needed more of a central midfielder, which Lo Celso is. We still had Eriksen at the club, so maybe there was a hope that we could squeeze something out of him for the rest of the season. But I think Lo Celso was the signing we needed. And of course, it doesn't mean that we don't need Fernandes as well. If it was one or the other, it's a very difficult decision to make. But I'm very happy with Lo Celso. Would have been ecstatic with the two, but I'm happy.
Bruno was a lot of money as well, wasn't he? He wasn't cheap. They had to really go big for him. He's a set piece specialist as well, and that is always very attractive, because I mean, set pieces, I think, at Spurs have been misused for a number of years. It's a potential to get a goal when you're not dominating a game. We've seen how Liverpool have used that to good effect over the last two seasons, but it's such an important piece of weaponry to have at your disposal. So they've got a free kick gem there in Bruno.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Next one, and I'm so shocked that Nathan put this question in. It's from Gage Reynolds, who I spoke to on his podcast, which is very enjoyable. He's a very nice...
Oh, is he the Swedish bloke?
No.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
Texan.
I'm getting confused.
Texan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, mate. I'm getting them mixed up.
You know, I got a lot of podcasts. Fine.
Gage. International podcast megastar.
You said it. So Gage says, what is the likelihood of traditional formations dying in the next 5 to 10 years? With fluid and asymmetrical shapes becoming more and more common, could the death of traditional formations be the next major theoretical evolution in the world of tech? But you like your tactical history. What do you feel on this one?
I'm quite looking forward to the no formations existing, and putting a video camera in like somebody's dad's house and watching as the team gets read out in alphabetical order and just watching people lose their minds. I don't know. It's very difficult to predict what's going to happen. I don't think we're going to lose traditional formations. I think that it's the staple of football, and formations have changed and adapted. But there's people moving back towards old 4-4-2s. There's kind of representations of the old WM formation in modern tactics. So I don't think we're ever going to lose them. And yeah, I just don't think that's going to happen.
Okay then, Nath, the floor is yours.
I think that formation's already very asymmetrical. I don't think that it's going to get that much more extreme. I think that obviously, like, you're going to see more asymmetry in your attacking shape and more symmetry in your defensive shape, because if there's asymmetry in your defensive shape, then there are obvious ways to exploit. But essentially, I think that we will continue to think of them in terms of their traditional form. So, like, when we, like, Mourinho sets up with a defensive left back, an attacking right back, and a wide left winger and an inside right forward or whatever, we just call that a 4-2-3-1. And I obviously, as the tactics dickhead on Twitter, do my sort of wonky formation graphic. But that's still just a 4-2-3-1 that we call a 4-2-3-1. Mm. We're not going to start calling that, you know, an asymmetrical three left dominant, you know, that sort of stuff. It's just, we'll just keep calling them the nearest thing, the basic idea, and start with the idea of the defensive shape. And yeah.
Does it bother you that that's quite reductive?
No. No, because I believe in, like, the simplicity of communication over accuracy or whatever.
Yeah, that's fair. I think in some respects this question sort of is linked to coaching as well. And I mentioned this earlier, that Spurs have a tendency to develop lots of sort of quite samey midfielders. And I'm not saying that that is a problem across the whole country. I don't think it necessarily is. But we are certainly, as a nation, developing more tactically and technically, particularly technically, rounded players. So even a defender coming through now has had a lot of technical coaching since they were incredibly young, because we've invested money into the elite academies as part of the elite player performance plan. And therefore, it allows you some flexibility with tactics that perhaps weren't there some time ago. And I think as that continues, it means you can be more flexible and more fluid with what you then do on the pitch in elite matches. And, you know, I think ultimately you're still going to have players whose job it is to put the ball in the net at one end, and players whose job it is to stop the ball going into your net. But there's definitely more of a blurring in those roles. I mean, we've seen the development of the fullback role over the past 20 years means that if you watch a game from 20 years ago, what fullbacks do then is so different to what the majority of fullbacks do now. And I think that will continue. So probably you'll see centre-backs carrying the ball out more, a bit like we've seen with Juan Foyth attempting to do unsuccessfully against Norwich, where we've ended up conceding. But that kind of thing, I don't think will be unusual. I think you will see players trusted to do more with the ball, to create overloads in areas of the pitch. We've also seen transitions become more important, and Nathan's spoken about counter-pressing already, but transitions are such an important part of the game now, whereas that terminology wasn't even used 20, 25 years ago. We're all familiar with what it means now. So rather than, you know, one team attacks, the ball goes out of play, then the other team attacks, the ball goes out of play, and sometimes one team attacks, the ball goes out of play, and then they attack again. It's much more fluid and dynamic than that now in most games. So you've got teams deliberately giving the opposition the ball in order to win it back high up the pitch. You've got these kind of different ways of playing which catch on and become fashionable and become accepted, and once players have played that style for one manager, they feel more comfortable with it, and they can go and play that style for another manager and pass it on, and things just evolve from there. So I think it's an interesting question that Gage asked, but I think ultimately, you know, you'll always have some form of sort of defense and attack within your team. It's just the balance of how that operates, and like I said, the blurring of the lines between attacking players and defending players that might get interesting. So Cameron Rogers says, even for players you might generally prefer not to sell, there exists a price at which you would rather have the money than the player. Taking into account Spurs' current situation, what would that number be for Son, and how about Dele? Bardi, we've spoken quite a lot about the potential need to sell one of our big players in the next transfer window. What kind of money would it take for you to consider selling Son or Dele?
I think Sun's got to be close to 100 million. I think Dele on current form is probably around 50, 60, but then he should be worth more than that. I think it's about being brave and not being scared to sell our best players. We sold one of our best players at Kyle Walker, and we replaced him with Trippier, and we did okay with that. That was a brave move to do, reinvest the money elsewhere. Just got to make sure that we're smarter when reinvesting the money. But selling your best players doesn't make you a selling club, which is a fear a lot of fans have.
And how about you, Nathan? If you had to put a figure on it, what would you be willing to sell Son Heung-min for?
Yeah, similar sort of things. I included this question because we talked about, or I put up the argument for selling Harry Kane in the previous episode. Obviously, you two pushed back, which is fair enough, but I wanted to include this question to sort of spin it around on you two and put you on the spot. So I want to hear your answer.
I mean, there's sort of two parts to it, isn't there? There's getting maximum value for the player and working out whether they've peaked and selling at the right time. And I think you could argue a case that we sold Kyle Walker at the right time, like Bardi says. We've got 47 million for him. He probably was briefly worth more than that once we sold him, but I would say he's probably worth less than that now, partly because of his age.
Yeah.
So I would argue that was a fairly successful sale. We failed to sell Danny Rose at his peak. We failed to sell Christian Eriksen at his peak. We failed to sell many, many players at their peak. And it is an issue at Spurs. But then the other part of it is sort of what the player gives to the club in the intangible elements of of them as a player and as a person. And both Son and Dele have such commercial appeal that it kind of makes them so much more valuable in other ways. And I think 100 million for a player of Son's ilk would be about right. But because of the commercial element, I think he's worth more than that. And I think we should demand more, someone like Son. And if a club is willing to pay 150, then fine, sell him. But unless that offer comes, then I'd keep him for a bit longer. I think he's the kind of player that will maintain value because of the commercial appeal. And the same for Dele. Abadi is exactly right that Dele's well below his peak market price at the moment. If we get Dele back to how he was playing 2 years ago, he'll be worth double what he's worth at the moment. So why would you sell at that point? It'll be a silly decision. What do you think, Nath? Is that?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. That's fair. Like, there are still like dozens of Korean fans at every single Tottenham game, like years on. So, and that has got to have some kind of, and they also like, they've all got like Sun 7 shirts as well. So like, that's got to have some kind of, financial advantage. So I think that's a very fair point in terms of what that does for the club. I remember when we bought him for 22 million, a lot of fans were saying, oh, we're just buying him for the market appeal. But like, what a player he has been for us. And yeah, Dele, so you mentioned Eriksen, you said that we didn't sell him at his peak. I disagree. I think we have sold him at his peak. It's just that he's been really off form at his peak. And so the timing is right, but not in terms of how that played out sort of on the pitch. And I think that like Dele's still very young, but it's a sort of a similar situation as you alluded to. You wouldn't sell him now because he's not perceived as good as he definitely is.
Yeah.
So we should wait until he's playing better before looking to cash in on him, basically.
And unlike what we did with Eriksen, we need to make sure these players are tied into lengthier contracts.
Yes.
Because that did not help with Eriksen at all. Final question is from Brian Schaffner. He says, can you spend a little time assessing Sessegnon? I had to have a run up at that one.
Sessegnon,
nice. Particularly with an eye to thinking about whether you see him as our starting left back down the road and how soon that could realistically happen. And he suggests perhaps next season. Bardi, what have you made of Sessegnon so far, and how would you kind of assess whether he could be a starting left back in the future?
I don't think we've seen enough of him, and I don't think he's played enough either for his own development. He looks like a player bereft of confidence. In the final game against Leipzig, there was moments where he collected the ball. I think it was perhaps in the build-up to maybe their first or second goal. He collected the ball in a dangerous area for Spurs, but lost all confidence on it and ended up just kind of floating a non-ball into their area, which they countered on us. And I think it was a moment in the second half as well where he just seems to have lacked all. He seems to have lost that sense of ability in himself to hold the ball, do something with it. And in the end, he's always looking for the easy out option, which costs us, especially when our midfield isn't great at winning the ball back. I think he needs time. I think he needs a left back who he can learn from. We all hoped, well, I hoped anyway, that Danny Rose could be that individual. It hasn't worked out. Ben Davies is continually struggling with fitness. I think he needs a good solid season, injury free, with almost like a mentor in front of him to really hit that level. I don't think he's in any position right now to be our starting left back going into next season.
Do you think that's fair, Nathan?
Yeah, I can understand all of that. Like, it's like, I've been really, really high on Sessegnon, and it's not like I'm not anymore. It's just that it's been a really disappointing season for him developmentally. Like, obviously he came in to play under Pochettino, under a player who maybe is over-regarded for his ability to nurture young players, but that's beside the point, and sort of develop that way and maybe start off getting some minutes on the wing and then move back to a left-back position. And now we're playing under Mourinho, where we play almost all games with a defensive left-back. And are there enough minutes for him? Can he pick up some minutes on the wing and all that kind of stuff? So it's been really frustrating. And his performances obviously haven't been great as a result, as you would expect. So I'm slightly worried about him and his development and his time at this club, because he is a really special footballer. I think if he can be a rounded left back, then that's a hell of a player that we potentially have there. It's interesting that he picked himself to play left back on his FIFA team. We did a little stream. They stole my idea, obviously. Sessegnon played against D'Antonio on Friday, and he played himself at left back. So he obviously certainly is open to the idea of seeing himself as a left back, but yeah, it's been frustrating with him basically this season. But he's good. He's really, really good.
Yeah, he's really, really good. I think people have got Sessegnon a bit wrong. They kind of don't understand what he is, because perhaps they haven't seen that much of him. He's not a player that gets the ball at his feet and takes his man on time after time, a bit like Danny Rose, and whips crosses in. That's not him at all.
I think he can be more that way.
Not from what I've seen personally. Like, I don't doubt that he can do bits of that, but that's not his, for me, those aren't his key strengths. So I think he's the kind of player who's very good at arriving. Like, he's got,
sure,
he's not fast, but he's got a good stride. He's got a really good stride. He's tall. And so he covers ground pretty quickly without having that kind of burst of acceleration. So he's very,
sure,
good at arriving in the right area. He's incredibly intelligent in the final third. So he's very, a bit like Dele, he's got that kind of ability to find space and time a run. And he's also an incredible final third passer from the left. Like,
yes,
for a fullback, he has excellent pass selection. And I think he's the kind of player that we'll see lots of assists from over the years. I see him way more as like a Christian Ziga figure than a Danny Rose figure, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Someone who will look for passes, arrive at the right time, but not like beat players for fun with the ball at his feet. That's, for me, that's not him. And I think if you get that idea out of your head, it becomes easier to just accept him for what he is. Having said that, I fully agree with what Bardi said, that he just looks so lost out there at the moment. And it's really sad to see. And I've seen it with Juan Foyth, who I think is a fantastic player and had a huge sort of loss of confidence. Obviously, we saw it with Kyle Walker-Peters as well. I know him to be a superb player who just totally lost his confidence. And I want these young players to be given time to build their confidence back up, because, I mean, it's much like the conversation we were just having about Dele. You'd end up losing them when they're nowhere near their peak value. So why not commit a little bit of time into building their confidence back up and hope that we get an elite level player? I think Sessegnon truly could be an elite level left back. He's certainly one for the future, and I hope that Spurs stick with him and give him an opportunity. I quite like Bardi's idea, though, of kind of a classy, more mature left-back who's got an understanding, good understanding of how to defend, taking on a kind of mentorship role. That seems quite attractive. Not sure if Ben Davies is that man.
I mean, Ben Davies is a player who has been number two all his life, but he's never let that affect him. He's tried to adapt his game. He's always done what his managers have asked. He filled in really well for Danny Rose for long periods under Pochettino. Sometimes when we're playing some of our best football, he's adapted and played in a back three for Wales. I think his attitude is great. He doesn't cause any problems. He gets on with the game, and he may lack perhaps technically and ability wise, but I think he's a really good role model for someone just to get your head down and focus on your game and improve, make those marginal gains in areas where you are good. I think Davies lacks it in certain places, but if he can get Sessegnon to really maximise his skills, then I think he could be a great mentor for Sessegnon.
I mean, you've sold it really well there. And you're right, he has got like the right personality for that role. I'm just not sure he's good enough. Mm. I know that sounds really horrible because, like you said, he has always been fully committed to Spurs and has never once moaned when he's been out of the team. And I always admire players like that. He's a proper kind of team man, but I just think he's that good. And I feel so bad saying it, but I just don't think he's up to it. But yeah, I mean, it's having Davis and Szczęsny on at left back is potentially not a problem, I would say. Nathan, you've got a little message before we sign off.
Okay, you want me to? Okay, so just that. Don't worry about like the lack of football at the moment on our end. We've got lots of plans for things that we're going to do, some of which is, again, our ideas have been stolen before they've even come to fruition for us by other podcasts. I guess that kind of makes it obvious. But we've got several things planned to sort of cover the next few weeks in terms of content, possibly looking at sort of some live things maybe, but you know, stay tuned. Thanks for listening. Remain indoors and try not to think about the event.
Yeah, and Nathan's had some really good ideas about sort of, like you said, sort of community event, bringing together the Extra Inch community, because we appreciate that these are difficult times and people need distraction in the form of two idiots and one genius talking about their beloved Tottenham Hotspur. So if we can kind of get like-minded people together to be distracted from the horrors of the modern world briefly, then we will try and make that happen. And keep in touch via our Twitter feed for news on that.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and SoundCloud D. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.